Aren't you interested in learning breakthrough wealth building strategies, such as how to flip a home in less than 2 weeks using other people's money with no real estate license, or how to build a low-cost home-based business? You can discover how to take passive income from any source and invest it into real estate, stocks, or business to become financially independent investing in any market with Residual Roads Business Institute. Collaborate with Andre and other Residual Roads advisors to create a free action plan and start implementing strategies today. Go to www.residualroads.com or email info@residualroads.com. Welcome to the Investing Uncensored podcast. You've been searching for different ways to become financially independent or generate passive income to live out your life's purpose as you've seen others do it, but need insight on how. Well, get excited because here you'll discover the tips and resources to fulfill that need. Andre Stewart has spent more than a decade successfully making it happen for himself and others. This is the Investing Uncensored podcast. And now here's your host, Andre Stewart.
Welcome to another episode of Investing Uncensored. I'm your host, Andre Stewart. And today we are fortunate to bring a great guest. He has some experience with the 08 crisis that happened in real estate, and he made it through. And it, to me, in my opinion, it looks like we're coming up on a similar crisis, if not worse. So it's great to have Kevin on so he can give us some insight on what to do and how he navigated through that experience and how to lead us out of this coming experience. So, Kevin, how are you doing, man?
I'm great, Andre. Thank you so much for having me. And talking about this is going to be tough and challenging and all of those words you can think of, because that was a pretty tough time in my life. A lot of people's lives, right?
Mm-hmm. I was just getting into banking at that point in time, so I don't have any experience with that 08, except for me seeing property values in 2012 that were like $25,000, $50,000, and those homes were like $200,000. Just 3 years prior to that. So yeah. I didn't get the luxury of being able to participate, but I'm in a better situation now. But if you can give us a little bit of background about, you know, how you got started in real estate, what made you choose this as your vehicle of choice for generating wealth, you know, dive into giving us some tips on what to do.
Yeah. So let's go back to high school. I hated high school, man. I wanted to be successful. I wanted to make money and I wanted all of those things, but I did not want to study. You know, it's just, I needed a break. So I was sold by a recruiter for the Army. Join the Army. Your country's going to love you and you'll play laser tag for a living. So they got me with the laser tag. I was like, I'll definitely go and do that. And it's true. It's laser tag. And it's not as fun as they had sold me on, but I had a great time. 3 years in the Army. And then I did 1 year in the Guard. And the thing in the Army is you don't spend very much money. So we were in the field a lot and I was living in the barracks. So I had this little savings account. So I'm thinking, like, what do I do with this money I want to invest in? I didn't know where to go. So I just started reading books, like all of us, right? And I picked up that purple Bible that we hear so much about, the Rich Dad, Poor Dad. It didn't stop there, but that's the one that kind of directed me towards real estate. And I just started reading and consuming real estate books. Mm-hmm. So I bought my first house. I was 21, just turning 21. And I had it ready to go when I got out of the Army, moved into it, got my roommates and moved out, rented it out. And I was like, holy cow, man, I got appreciation going on. I got my tenants paying off my mortgage for me. I was cash flowing pretty well for one little tiny house in Denver. And it was then that I decided, you know, this is going to be what I use to get rich. This is going to make me wealthy. I just got to figure out how to do it in volume, do it in scale. Mm-hmm. So I started focusing in on that. Mm-hmm. Started buying a house or two every month with no money, no credit. I was in college eating top ramen and I was doing it. So that's kind of how I got going.
You know, it's funny because I grew up, my parents were military, both of them. So I understand what you mean by it. I would see all these people that are in the, you know, E1s, driving super nice cars, living on base. So I just knew these guys had a lot of money and they were just spending it on, you know, hooking their cars up. But it's you took it and you did something different with it, which is buying real estate. So at that point in time, what was your thought process on, like, just buying rentals, or you were doing flips at that point in time? Because I don't know how far back that was, but.
Yeah. So this was in 2001 when I bought that first house. So it was right before 9/11 and the dot-com bubble. So that was like 2008, you mentioned that in the intro there, and that was actually my second legit recession that I went through. Mm-hmm. So I went right through the dot-com, which didn't really impact real estate much. And I was pretty young, so I didn't necessarily feel that one as much. Mm-hmm. But I do know that there were some foreclosures around me. And so I wanted to learn the foreclosure business. And I went to one of those weekend seminars, you know, the ones I'm talking about with everybody's on stage selling you something. Uh-huh. And I was at one of those and I bought a program on foreclosures and it was really focused in on the short sales. The idea is, look, you could find properties with little or no equity. And you could create equity by negotiating with the lender to pay them less than what's actually owed. And then that negotiation would create the profit. You would create the equity and then you could flip out of it and make some money. You either fix it up and flip it, or you could flip it to another investor and have them do the rehab, right? So then we call that wholesaling. Mm-hmm. And so I was sold. I was like, this is the program. Holy cow, why isn't everybody doing this? And I had a little coach that was kind of mentoring me and helping me through it. And here's the advice I got, Andre. Why don't you go ahead and I got a good lead. Why don't you go ahead and get the deed to the house? Because that way you're in control of it. And then go to the bank and negotiate with the bank. And it just sounded so easy and like almost too good to be true, right? Mm-hmm. And the seller gave me the deed. That is true. So this is the first house I bought without paying off any loans. The problem is I had to give him $3,000 and I didn't have it. So I brought in a partner to help fund that $3,000 for me, gave it to the seller. He gave me the deed to his house. And then I went to the bank and started the negotiation. The problem is the bank said no. So now I have a deed to a house that has a loan on it that's more than the house is worth, and they're committed to foreclosure. So they did. They foreclosed, wiped me right off the title. I was unable to save the seller's credit. So they got the foreclosure on their credit report. And I was like, you know what? This foreclosure game isn't as easy. I don't know if I like this so much. And then I learned the lease options. And that's the one that really got me going. Because now I'm talking about buying pretty homes in pretty neighborhoods and just renting them out and letting them go up in value over time. There's no pressure to get the absolute best deal. And so I really just started hammering the phones and calling landlords and just asking them if they would do a lease option with me. And that's how I was doing one to two a month. It's interesting because I was buying those houses from motivated sellers. I was setting up my appointments to go meet with them as I was walking between classes on campus. So I would hammer out a call or two calls while I'm walking across the campus between classes. And then on the weekends, I'd go out and meet with them and see if I can negotiate with them.
It's funny because I started in real estate the same exact way that you just said.
Really?
The exact same way. And then I brought Victor Bell on maybe three podcasts back. He started doing real estate the same way that you did. And it's funny that people are always like, well, you have to be rich to get into real estate and you don't. And so you just gave an example on how you got started. And obviously you needed, $3,000, which you wouldn't have got that from somebody else, but you still got into real estate with not needing a lot of money. And so I have a book called The Real Estate Investing Diet where I break down the exact strategy on what you just explained. But I'm curious, what was the name of the course that you took? What was the guy's name?
Yeah, so it was David Finkel and Peter Conti. So Peter Conti, I just love that guy. And I got their book, the Multiple Streams of Income book, and then their second book. And so I used those two books and I bought two houses just from reading the books because I was just calling people. It's like, if you call enough people and you try hard enough, you're going to hear a ton of no's and you're going to fail and you're going to make mistakes. And all of those things are true, but you're also going to get some success too. Exactly. So I got a few successes and got a little bit of money in the bank at that point. And then I went and joined their mentorship program. And that's really where I accelerated.
So in your opinion, you think it would be best to start that route versus fixing and flipping? And you like pretty houses as well. It just seemed like it's easier.
I think it's easy because look, a lease option, how easy is that? I'm going to lease the property from you and promise your payments every single month, whether there's a tenant or not. Mm-hmm. We're going to lock in a price so there's no movement there. And I'm going to buy it at some point in the future. It's a very simple concept to explain. Mm-hmm. So it's easy for you to sell it to a seller, a motivated seller, and they don't have to be so ridiculously motivated that they'll just deed the house to you, right? Still stay on title. Mm-hmm. So I eventually got into the more subject to and land contracts and those types of things, but it takes a pretty motivated seller just to give you their house, right? So it's nice to have both or multiple tools in the tool belt, and focusing on one to start is very smart because you get very good at it. I suggest to a lot of people the lease option, but wholesaling, a lot of people like to wholesale too. It's harder because you got to get big spreads in the find, but there's no risk and it's immediate cash. So I think either way is fine. There's lots of ways to make money in this business, right? I chose that one and it worked really well for me. So it's hard. Yeah, I'm biased.
But you know what though? Everyone, you had a mentor, I had a mentor, Victor had a mentor. People don't understand how having a mentor just takes out the barrier for entry and the low risk involved in that.
Yeah.
I'm going to mention this again. The real estate investing diet breaks down to everything that he's just saying. If you can elaborate a little bit more on your lease option strategy for people to understand that. Because I talk about subject twos, but give your example on a lease option.
Yeah. So it's kind of like I described. So you got let's say a seller, I'm thinking one right now that's coming to the top of my head. He had to go to graduate school. He got accepted to a graduate program and it was in another state. So he was currently living in Colorado, working with his wife and baby, and got accepted to this program that he really wanted to go. So he moved, but now he has two home payments, right? Because he's got his family. He's moving them all out of town, and now he's got two house payments. Now he's not so motivated, like they're foreclosing on him. Kind of motivated, he was able to keep it going for a little while, but he was motivated enough to know that, hey, I can't afford to go two payments for too long. So we need to get some payment pressure relief. So I came in and said, well, why don't I just lease the property from you for the next 7 or 10 years? You won't have to worry about the payments at all anymore. And then I'm going to make some money on this. I am an investor and that's my business. And I always say that right up front. That helps with the negotiation because it brings their fight or flight syndrome down.
Correct.
So I get that out there. And then look, I'm going to rent it out to somebody. I'm going to charge them a little bit more than I pay you. And then as the value of the house goes up, I'm just super upfront about it. As the value goes up and this agreement becomes more valuable to me, I'm gonna exercise my option and buy you out for that price. Make sure you get your loan paid off.
Exactly.
So it's really that simple, and it's an easy concept. And there's all these nuances, right, on how you can negotiate it. Like I used to do a lot of 30-year lease options, and I'd get people asking me, like, how do you tie up a property with a lease for 30 years? And it's actually quite simple. I just asked the seller, well, how long do you want to not have to worry about this payment? Well, and the answer is, well, I don't ever want to worry about the payment, right? Well, how much more time do you have on your lease or your mortgage? About 28, 29 years, whatever the number is. Well, doesn't it make sense, Mr. Seller, that we just do the agreement for the amount of time that you don't want to worry about it, right? And now I just did a 28-year lease option. That gives me tons of flexibility if the market crashes like it did in 2008. Correct. Right? I could weather that storm because I have plenty of time.
What I want to, you know, mention really fast is I'm going to bring it up again because I think this is a great point. Like to hear you talking about it again in the Real Estate Investing Guide, Chapter 4, I believe, Acquisition and Exit Strategies. I break this down and I call it a sandwich lease option because he has a spread between the interest that he's getting from the bank and the amount that he's loaning it to the person that's doing the lease option, which is a great thing. So mentioned in my book, I know you wrote a book as well, 45 Day Investor. So elaborate on that. Do you talk about something? I mean, some of the things that we're saying right now in that book?
Yeah. Yeah. It was started out as a biography. And the reason I did that is because I was in the Real Estate Association here in town. And here I am, this 23, 24, 25-year-old kid. Mm-hmm. And I'm buying a house or two a month. I had a big portfolio. I had over 50 properties. Oh, and nice. So these... at this association, people would see that and hear that. And so they were very attracted to that. So I had constantly people coming up to me, asking me how I was doing it. Can you give me some advice? Look at this deal, look at this deal. So it was constant. Mm-hmm. So I decided to just write a book. It was like, my gosh, there might be a demand for this. People keep asking me. So I started it out as a biography, like the exact process that I went through. Mm-hmm. And it turned into more of a how-to book. So it has all the agreements that I used. It has very specific language on how to negotiate these types of deals, scripts and all of that. Yeah. So it's really that. Lots of stories, good, the good and the bad, because I make a ton of mistakes. But I just laid out the lease option strategy for anyone to use. And the idea of the 45-day investor is you could buy a property with little or no money down in 45 days or less. And it really is possible.
For sure. 100%. And I think you guys, is it on Amazon?
It is on Amazon. Yep. 45dayinvestor.com. And it'll take you right to the page.
I think you guys should look into it based on what he's saying. I mean, him, myself, Victor, all kind of give you an idea on how to get into real estate without having a lot of money. And clearly he didn't come from a rich family because he was obviously in the military, right? Or am I wrong? Right.
So no, we were, I felt middle class to be quite honest with you, but we were lower middle at best. I lost my mom when I was very young. And so my dad raised me and my brother and my sister, and he just worked his little ass off trying to support us and raise us. And he wanted us to have a middle-class life and he gave up everything. I mean, he gave up his retirement. He gave up any savings he had, anything just to get us to the point where we're on our own. We didn't have the luxuries, right?
Exactly.
We lived in a suburban middle-class neighborhood, but I didn't get to do three sports a year. I didn't get to go skiing. I didn't get to go, I didn't have the biggest Christmases like my friends did. I didn't have any of that. Mm.
Have you ever thought to yourself, I wish I could get into real estate investing? You can change this as quickly or as slowly as you want to now. Imagine yourself networking and making new connections in real estate globally, or buying an investment property in a market or country that fits your needs. People do. They know what I'm talking about. And now you can too with InvestFar. Connect and join the network. Remote investing made safe and easy.
I like pointing that out because everyone I bring on here, because there's this narrative going around, right? That people are always coming at rich people, right? If you live in the US, then you know there's an attack on people that have generated wealth for whatever reason. But the thing about it is most people don't have millionaire friends, right? They see someone post something on Instagram that they follow, and that person may look like they're rich, but they don't know the person's actual real status. They don't know how that person, or they don't, they're based on something that they believe, but ask any millionaire. 90% of them or 95% of them had to get it from grinding and doing what we're talking about doing right now. So I just like to point out that most people didn't come for money. So why are people coming at folks that put the work in, that grinded for 20, 30 years to be able to generate that kind of wealth? You know what I mean?
Well, we could debate that for a while. it's entitlement. I mean, we live in a country with the sense of entitlement, and our governments created that. I mean, look at what happened during COVID. Mm-hmm. I mean, you can't just give away that much stuff and money and not create some, condition the mind to expect that, right?
Correct. And so now it's just, I call it a handout culture, especially if I'm pretty sure you've traveled and you've gone to other countries, and you know there's a huge difference between how things go and, how it goes here. But we have this handout culture now. So there's an expectation that, people that have it or grinded for it, they should automatically just give it away just because we don't have it. Yeah, but what about the people that put the work in for the 15, 20 years that sacrificed? Why do we all of a sudden have to just do this? Because, I don't know. I don't agree with that. So, but you know what? That's the segue into what I'm going to say now. So a lot of people generate wealth during recessions and depressions. So this would be an ideal time for people to generate wealth, just like the other people that they're complaining about or that they want things from. So give us, I guess, your story on how you made it through 08. And what it looked like when you got through it, and what's the parallels to what you see going on right now?
I'm gonna go there. I'm gonna get to that, but I want to mention this. I find it so interesting where we're going right now. I don't know how long until you actually publish this, but we are in a situation where the government is creating a recession. Right? It's very intentional. It's very planned. And when you have a recession, like you just described, it creates a separation of wealth because the wealthy can take advantage of that. And the not wealthy, they don't understand it well enough or have the resources to take advantage. They're the ones that actually get hurt. So the high inflation, I don't like it. I'm not suggesting that, but I'm telling you that it's the most fair tax there is. So we have to pay for all this spending, right? The only way to do that is through inflation, and inflation hits everybody the exact same. So that's why I think that's why you see the more separation, and the government will tell us too big to fail. They don't want the separation of wealth. They want to share the wealth. They want to do all of these things, but they create the situation that creates that separation. I just find it very interesting. So back to your question, you were talking about 2008. Now, 2008 was not easy for me. See, I made one of the biggest mistakes of my life when I set incorrect goals. So people ask me, like, what's some advice you would give your previous self or yourself 20 years ago or whatever? it's always like, be very intentional and smart with your questions to yourself and others and to your goals that you're making for yourself. Because if you have a mindset of accomplishing goals and you know, we talk about your why, how big is your why and how strong is that why? If your why is strong enough and you set goals, you're going to hit those goals.
100%.
And that's a lot of successful people, high achievers that are probably listening to your podcast. They hit their goals. So if you set goals that are not beneficial to you, you'll hit them and it's going to hurt you. So what I did was I was so excited about all the attention I was getting at the RIAs and my friends and family. Like, so I was like, well, I could talk about how many doors I have. I could talk about how many houses. I could talk about the tangible numbers. But what we don't talk about is how profitable are you? How much risk are you taking and how much effort are you putting in? You know, and you never hear anyone talk about any of those.
Correct.
And so I was like, well, I just want to buy a bunch of houses so I could feel cool to my peers. So I had the goal of 1-2 houses a month, which I was absolutely able to hit, but I was buying houses that didn't benefit me. Mm. And so when we got into 2008 and everything started falling in and collapsing in around us, I had a lot of interest only debt, adjustable rates, and I had a lot of over leveraged properties. So I really got hurt in 2008, which pretty much anyone that was in the industry did, but I almost lost everything. What saved me was the lease options because I could renegotiate those.
Mm, I like it. So you kind of were in the situation, but not really. Your portfolio was at stake, but since you were in a lease option, it was more so on the person who had loan.
Yeah. So when I do my lease options, I'm not sure how you do it. I'd be curious to hear what you think about this. But one of the strategies I use is I'll do a 12-month term that automatically renews for 10, 15, 20 times. So every year it renews for another year. That way at any given time, I could get out of that agreement. Yeah. I'm not stuck in that for a long period of time. And that gives me a ton of negotiation power. So as my lease options were coming up on their annual renewal, I would be calling the seller, look, this is the situation we're in. We're in the worst recession since the Depression. In fact, some statistics say in housing, it was even worse. And we're not going to be able to continue the agreement like we are. Do you want me to turn this house back over to you? Or can I continue to help you, but at a lower price where I could, you know, be safe? And so those are the phone calls I was making, and I was able to renegotiate almost all of them. I think there was like 5 or 6 that I ended up turning back to the seller. Mm-hmm. But I didn't get hurt on any of them, right? And we were able to get through those. Now, the ones that I had my own personal name on, my own debt on, adjustable rate loans, all those payments were going up. Rents were coming down starting in 2007. Those ones I ended up turning back over to the bank. I lost those. So I was able to save all my owner carry stuff, and I gave up my stuff. I didn't want to hurt them, if that makes sense.
No, that makes sense. In essence, the ones that you were doing seller financing on, those worked out. But then the ones you had to give back to the bank, did that affect your credit at all?
Oh, yeah. Wrecked my credit. And I did a bunch of subject twos also. So all of those, I didn't default on any of those. I defaulted on my own loans before I defaulted on somebody else's. So I made it through with all of those just fine. I was just taking losses every month, right? So I had to go get a job. I had to get some other income coming in so I can keep making those payments.
One thing that I want to point out that's great to hear you say this, your credit got ruined, but you were still able to be in real estate, right? Because of the strategy that you just said. So anyone that's listening that says, oh, I got bad credit, I can't get into real estate, he just showed you that you can. And he showed you actually a better way to do it where you don't even have to use your credit, in essence, because he did the seller financing.
Yeah.
So with that being said, go ahead. If
you want to, I was just going to say, not one time, Andre, has anyone ever said, what's your credit score? What's your credit report look like? Can I pull your credit? I've never had one seller ask me. And I did well over 100 deals and no one's ever asked me that.
Yeah, they don't care because they're in a situation and they don't want to be paying 2 mortgages. So they're willing to give it up to somebody that can show that they can pay a year in a contract. And at the end of the day, they're not really losing anything because they still get to keep the loan in their name. So if it doesn't work out, they just terminate it with you and do it with someone
else.
That's exactly. They don't really care. I like to point out that just like one thing that you said, go back maybe like 2 minutes, is like people see the glory, but they don't know the story. Piggyback up what you were saying.
That's right.
It's just like one of those things that this is just highlighted too much. So what do you see as far as the parallels between 08 and right now? Like we know, like you said, inflation is an invisible tax. They're intentionally, I mean, markets cycle every 7 to 10 years. We're like 12 years past when we were supposed to have a recession. It should have happened in 2019, but the Fed did what they did and it postponed it. And so now I think it's going to be worse than it would have been in 2019 and worse than it would have been in 08 because we have more debt. So what do you think we are right now? Do you, I keep saying, I think by the time the summertime gets here, especially by the end of the year, it's going to be all out calamity. What do you think?
I think you might be right. I think residential might be somewhat insulated, and I'll go into detail about that. But I, you know, there was a technical recession. It was, they did
technical
name it a recession in 2020. Right. Mm-hmm. But did it feel like that?
No,
not at all. Right. Mm-hmm. It feels worse now than it did then. And they're still not calling this a recession. And the reason for that is unemployment, which is so bizarre, because before it wasn't unemployment. It wasn't inflation. It wasn't interest rates. It was negative GDP, right? It was the inverted yield curve. These are the things that we were talking about before. Now it's, well, I don't even know what a recession is. Honestly, I have no idea. I think we're in a recession, and I think they're going to announce it when the unemployment rate starts going up a little bit. But to answer your question about comparing 8 to now, I don't see the comparison, other than it's impacting housing. Actually, I don't even know if this one will. We could talk about that too. But I don't see a ton of resemblance, because 2008 was so unique. It was such an anomaly. It was created by Wall Street greed. They were doing things that makes absolutely no sense. If you start looking at, if you look at the Consumer Credit Availability Index, that if you guys Google that, you guys, if you want to see something very interesting, is the Credit Availability Index. It was like 900 in 2007 before the crash. And it floats around 100 now. So it's like not even close to the same quality of financing. And it's been that way since then. And we have record low loan to values. We have 40% of our homes free and clear. We have record FICO scores. Like an average score is like 760 or something ridiculous. These are high quality loans that we're entering this recession with. Nothing compared to 2008. What I do think it compares to is the savings and loans crisis. Now that was in the 80s and the early 90s.
Right.
I wrote a report comparing that crash to what we're going through right now. I give that away to your listeners for free if you want. But high inflation, high interest rates, an attack on commercial real estate, and then maybe some hit to the residential side. That's very much more similar to what we're seeing than 2008.
I agree with that. I think is going to be comparable. Obviously, we won't have, it was crazy amount of homes at that point in time because of predatory lending. I mean, people had like 4 and 5 houses. I remember seeing a documentary where strippers had like 5 houses. It was crazy. Mm-hmm. So the parallels I see is that I think when we get to like 4 or 5 unemployment, I think that's where it's going to come, where people are going to be motivated sellers. So I think we might have a foreclosure crisis, but not to the level of what it was back then. I think we'll just see a lot of people losing their home because they can't afford it. And there's more equity in the homes at this point in time as well versus back then. That's the only thing that I see that's similar.
Yeah, but we didn't have Airbnbs back then, and we didn't have the same demand back then. So we have an absolute crisis in inventory right now with a high demand.
Correct.
So it would take a significant, like you would have to double inventory twice to get kind of to a normal type of market. Mm-hmm. I don't know where that inventory comes from. I agree with you that unemployment will have an impact, but it's not going to be through foreclosures because there's record loan to values, right? There's record equity. So we'll start seeing these dribble in on the just a regular MLS type stuff.
But the thing I think was going to probably hurt is that if people can't afford to buy those houses because the interest rate is super high.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah. So people are not going to be able to afford it. And so if this person lost their house and they're trying to get rid of it, even if they tried to refinance it and pull out cash, right, they're refinancing at a higher value and that payment is going to be a lot higher. And so that's what I think that might cause an issue.
You know, except for 40% of owners don't have a debt at all. So there's still demand. Yeah.
So that's it'll be a different type of, I think we'll see a correction in the housing prices for sure, but not like an influx of like 2 million homes in the market. Yeah, okay.
I can get on board with that. I think we're going to get hit is a commercial. I think we're going to see 2008-ish value declines, but only this time it'll be on the commercial side.
Which is going to be a great opportunity, but most people can't really get into, you know what, depending on the type of commercial, you can do some seller financing. It's just, can that person listening to this podcast or the average person afford a commercial mortgage payment?
Well, the idea in commercial, you know, the idea in commercial is that the building pays for it, right? Otherwise, and that's the problem. Mm-hmm. There's a debt service coverage ratio, and banks require between 1.2 and 1.3 as a debt service coverage ratio, which means the building is going to produce 120 to 130% of what's needed to pay the debt. Mm-hmm. So if you're seeing stuff like that and interest rates are starting to reset because of rates are twice as high as they were when they took out the loan, mm-hmm. that's where these are going to start coming in on the market. And seller financing, honestly, is way more common on the commercial side than it is on the residential side.
I think people don't know that. So then, you know, we're coming up on time, but if you can give the listeners a great way to find these type of deals, you know, what kind of leads are you getting? You do mailers, or what's your process?
Yeah, so we're doing some commercial stuff right now. I get some leads, but they're all coming from brokers. So I just got back from this fantastic commercial mastermind. It's something I go to every single quarter. It's a very expensive, exclusive group. I love it, though, because everyone in there is very active. And I could tell you that around 60%, best I could judge, is from brokers. So it's just networking with commercial brokers. And I'll tell you what, they're hungry now because they're not seeing the transactions they were before. So where maybe a year ago or 6 months ago, they wouldn't return your phone call because you're a brand new investor. Well, now they're going to return your phone call. And so now it creates some good opportunities. As far as mailers, yeah, mailers work. They do, but not as well as they do in the residential real estate side. We're talking about more sophisticated owners here. Mm-hmm. So I really like brokers, and I think where you're going to find them, if it gets to the brokers, that's probably a good way to do it because a lot of banks will go through a broker network, but you're going to start seeing defaults because of the debt service coverage ratio, like I talked about. So special servicers and regional and local banks, I would be trying to build those relationships now. So when they start getting these back, they have someone to call.
And then, you know, a lot of people can try to go to LoopNet, but by the time it hits LoopNet, it's too late, right? That's already retail and you're not going to get a good deal.
Yeah, and you could set up your filter so you get emails, opportunities, and that's a good way to go. But I'll tell you the biggest benefit with LoopNet or Crexy or any of these others is to get in touch with the broker so you can build that relationship. Very rare where you buy the property that's actually on the website.
Correct. But like you said, get into their funnel, right? Get on like a drip campaign where you say, hey, send me anything that comes up. And brokers make a lot of money if they can sell a commercial property. So they're like, yes, give me as many buyers as possible because that pool of investors is a lot smaller than on the residential side.
You're exactly right.
If you can, you know, give us two things that a person should do right now if they're thinking about getting into real estate and what they should look out for. And then I always ask the last question is some books that you can recommend because it's all about mindset. And you said it earlier on. So give us a couple books in addition to yours and mine.
So the mindset thing, I was going to say yours and mine, that's the ones because we're both focused on the owner carry stuff. And I think that that's where the opportunity is, especially if you don't have the dry powder. If you have the dry powder, I think commercial is where the opportunity is because there's going to be steep, steep discounts. But if you don't have the relationships to bring in private capital or you don't have the money yourself, that's going to be a tougher game to play. But we're talking about owner carry financing for residential property. Now you're dealing with a little bit less sophisticated owner that really needs help. These are the people that you can go in there and help them. So they might have 30-year money at 3%, 2.5%.
Exactly.
And you don't want to pay that off, right? So if you could work out a deal where they could leave that in place and you could take ownership of the property, I think it's a fantastic opportunity. So I think that's where I would go, especially if I was newer. But here's the advice. Please, please hear me here. Don't try to do it all or don't. There's going to be shiny objects. Absolutely. We're hitting a recession and it's hitting real estate. You're going to see lots of opportunities. Stay focused. As soon as you start shopping around and chasing that squirrel or that shiny object, that's when you're not going to make very much money. If you could focus in on the subject to or lease option and just hammer that, you'll make far more money, have far more success. So if there's anything that I know I'm being all emotional about this, but this is what will help you be successful, this piece of advice. So focus in on one thing.
This is exactly what I've been preaching for like the last 7 or 8 months. So it's like so refreshing for you to come on and be so passionate because I'm like that on my podcast. And I'm like, they're like, why is he screaming? Because I'm just like, this is where the opportunity is. So I'm just like, you know, I want people to do what we've done, right? You know, come from nothing and make a lot of money. So it's just like, this is why we're so adamant about doing this particular strategy. This is why we both wrote a book about it, because that's what the people that came before us did that made money. So we're just paying it forward and because we know that's what the best thing to do is.
Yeah, it works. And once you get really good at it, fantastic. Now go chase the next shiny thing. Keep this going so you have some income and then chase something. But don't try to chase it all at once.
Exactly.
And I just know that those opportunities are going to come. So I know people have that tendency.
Exactly. Listen to Kevin. Listen to me too, but you know. But again, Kevin, thank you for coming on, man. And I know you got your own podcast. If you can, let people know what the name of it is and how they can find it.
Yep. We're just starting to record episodes now. So here's the thing. I've been being interviewed on these different podcasts, just like this one. We're having so much fun and I get to learn and talk to people and help people, hopefully. And it's like, why can't I just do my own podcast also? I should probably be doing this. So we're starting now. We're just getting it going. It's called the Real Estate Educators Podcast. And I'm really focusing on people that are educating other educators or educating investors. So that's the focus. I don't know how to get to it yet because we haven't even released any yet, but we're going to get that done and I'll get you on maybe when we get a little bit of audience going and we can share it that way. But I would like to say, it looks like we're almost out of time here. I do want to give out that report if that's okay.
Go ahead.
Shoot. Yeah. Thepinereport.com, thepinereport.com. And it does a really detailed comparison of 1990 crash to what we're going through right now. I think it's going to be hugely beneficial for anyone that's exploring real estate investments in this environment.
Take a look at it, guys. Kevin, thank you for coming on and we'll be in touch.
Right, Andre.
Have you on again soon.
Thanks.
Aren't you ready to start a business or grow your real estate investing portfolio? If you answered yes, allow Andre and the expert advisors at the Residual Roads Business Institute to fast track and put you on a path to full-time investing. The greatest transfer of wealth in our lifetime is occurring over the next few years, and you can take advantage if you know what to look for. In order to be successful at real estate investing, you need to learn how to leverage your current resources to generate quick money, big money, and retirement money. Let Residual Roads advisors craft a plan to get you through these phases using little or no money in 6 months or less. Don't wait for a job. Create one for yourself and others. Go to residualroads.com for mentorship and for our free course, go to residualroads.thinkific.com.